Hi, I'm Sally Popper, and I'm going to be talking today about attachment and the clinical implications of attachment theory and research. I'll spend a lot of our time today talking about what attachment is and how it develops. Some of what I'm saying may not seem relevant to you as a clinician, but I think you'll find, if you stick it out, that understanding how attachment really works in human development will give you insights into clients who didn't receive sensitive and responsive caregiving as young children. If you know enough about attachment, it is often possible to identify where a client is stuck developmentally. And if you understand how attachment develops, you can tailor therapy to fill in some of those deficits. So we'll start with, what is attachment? Attachment is established in the first year of life, primarily in the second 6 months. Attachment is the exclusive relationship between a child and a caregiver. Once it's established, no one can replace an attachment figure without very hard work. Attachment evolved evolutionarily, we believe, as a way for the child to maintain safety. John Bowlby read a lot of evolutionary information. He was studying Charles Darwin when he came up with his theories about attachment. And he believed that attachment evolved to ensure the survival of the species. Human babies, unlike most other animals, have almost no skills to care for themselves. And it's critical that they have a strong instinct to seek their caregivers when they're in danger. It's also critical that the caregivers have a strong instinct to provide that safety. So the fundamental quality of attachment is that it is safety-seeking. It's activated by threat, by hunger, by tiredness, by sickness, and the child seeks closeness to the caregiver. It's important to focus on this safety-seeking aspect of attachment because when you see clients who have not had a safe and secure attachment when they were young, it becomes very relevant clinically, and we will be discussing that later. Another fundamental building block of attachment is that it is and provides affect and arousal regulation. The caregiver in the attachment relationship is able to regulate the child's emotions and the child's level of arousal. If you think about it, a baby is very disorganized and doesn't have good regulation of body states or of feelings. And different states and feelings will come and go in a newborn. That gradually changes over time, and it's the result, the direct result of caregiving. We'll be talking a lot more about this important function of attachment relationships later. Attachment begins in utero, although you can't say that a baby is attached before they are born, certainly, and across the first days and months of life, as the baby learns the rhythm, the sounds, and the smell of mother. After birth, the baby learns how promptly his parents respond to his or her needs and how well they provide comfort. The baby learns how it feels to be calmed and regulated by parents. And the baby learns to experience joy with parents. And although experiencing joy may seem like a sort of a side effect or a small aspect of attachment, it actually is a very important piece of the child's early development. Over a lifetime, an infant's security of attachment is one of the strongest predictors of psychological and social outcomes in later childhood. That doesn't mean that there can't be other impacts of other events that are equally predictive. But it is it provides a basic direction which can be changed, or it can go on. And if there is continuing similar caregiving, the original attachment patterns become stronger and stronger. That said, I want to tell you the story I heard this summer from Alan Schroff. He wrote a wonderful book on attachment over a lifetime. He's been doing a study of children, high-risk children in Minnesota now for about 40 years, and he's beginning to see the third generation of children and studying throughout what attachment patterns he finds. He told the story of one of the young boys in his study who was very securely attached as an infant, looked great. At around 5 or 6, his parents had a bitter divorce, and his father took his brother. He stayed with his mother. He was not looking quite as good at this point, but was still fairly strong. When he was around 12, he began to push away from his mother, as many early teens do, and he began to experiment with some hanging out with kids who might not have been the best kids, and he began to get into behaviors that weren't so positive. Just at that moment, his mother died quite suddenly. And that plunged him into some very negative behavior during his teenage years. And if you'd seen him during his teenage years, you wouldn't have thought that this was a securely attached, well-developing child. He was involved in a fair amount of deviant behavior. But later, in his 20s, he found a partner with whom he had a child. And at the last point in the study, Alan Schroff said, his child was showing a secure attachment to him, and he was showing a secure model of attachment as an adult. So this was an example of the ways in which a child's development can change over time, still having the base of attachment. And Schroff's point was that the secure base he had to start with reemerged when he found a strong partner as an adult and had a child himself. And that secure base that he had did serve him well in the long run, although you might not have thought that when he was a teenager. Attachment is primarily a right brain process. In the first 3 years of life, the right hemisphere of the brain is developing rapidly, and the left hemisphere is coming along a little more slowly. The right brain includes more emotional learning, contextual learning. It's more the forest, whereas the left hemisphere is more the trees. It's got more social learning. And it has what is called implicit memory, which is memory that is not stored verbally. The left brain is more rational, logical, has to do more with what we think of as learning and school and so forth. In the first 3 years, prior to real language use by a child, the right hemisphere is dominant, and it is, as I said, developing rapidly. Attachment is primarily a right brain process. And I mentioned implicit memories. Memories in the first 2 or 3 years are implicit, and that's one reason that we don't usually remember things that have happened to us in the first years of life, because those memories are stored in our brains on the right hemisphere, and there aren't words for them. But I think if you think of an experience you've had, and one of the ways I like to remember what an implicit memory is to think of entering a house where you catch a smell, and smell is one of the most direct routes to our right brain. You catch a smell that reminds you of your grandmother's house. That suddenly you are surrounded by the memory of your grandmother's house. This isn't something that you remember, oh, in my grandmother's house, the couch was on the left and the curtains were on the right and the chair here was red. Those aren't the memories you have of your grandmother's house. The memories are more holistic. That's a right brain implicit memory. The whole scene will come back to you, the feelings, the smells, the look, the temperature, all of those sensory aspects of the experience will pop right into your mind. And those are implicit memories. And so we all have lots of them. But for most of the memories of things we've done, we have more explicit memory, which is stored in our left hemisphere. And that can be talked about in words, and you can remember this happened first, that happened next, and so forth. But the other place you find implicit memories when you're doing therapy, which is an important one to know, is when a person's been severely traumatized. When you're traumatized, your brain begins to work very efficiently to help you fight, flee, or freeze. And suddenly your left hemisphere is offline. So the memories of trauma are often implicit memories. They're not verbally encoded. They don't go through the hippocampus, which is the way in which memories get sort of filed away in the filing cabinets of our brain. They actually just get stored directly into the right hemisphere. So that's why if you've had a trauma, you may experience flashbacks in which suddenly the entire traumatic scene is there in front of you, and it feels as if you're reliving it. That's an implicit memory coming to the surface. So there are many ways in which implicit memories are important clinically, but one way is that in this first 2 to 3 years, lots of information is encoded in the right brain, but we don't have access to it verbally. And that's an important feature for therapy because working with pre-verbal memories is difficult since we tend to work verbally. So we'll talk a little bit more about that later. Right brain skills are many, and these are all skills that are learned in the attachment relationship. Children don't learn these without an attachment relationship. These include reading social cues, regulating affect so that you don't blow up suddenly out of context, you don't shut down inappropriately. You can manage your feelings in a fairly smooth manner. Communicating nonverbally, which as we know is a really important aspect of communication. Inhibiting impulses, which if you think about it, is one of our more critical skills. The fact that I'm sitting here right now and not jumping up and moving around or thinking of something I want to call someone about or that kind of thing is a function of my ability to inhibit my impulses. And for a child to succeed in school, certainly, but even with friends or in a home, it requires that they're able to inhibit impulses. Another right brain skill is focusing attention, certainly critical for most things we do in life. Understanding cause and effect is a critical right brain skill, and it's one that caregivers teach babies. Learning to plan, which includes understanding cause and effect, because if you're learning to plan, you think, if I do this, that's likely to happen. Maybe I don't want to have that happen, so maybe I should do something else instead. Let's think about what would happen if I did that. These are all taught in the attachment relationship. Often we call these executive function skills, and they are critical skills if you haven't learned them in an attachment relationship in the first years of life. It's much harder to teach them later, but it's critical that therapists, teachers, and parents do that at a later time. And actually, that's one of the problems I have with therapy for children who've had attachment losses and trauma, where the therapy focuses only on the trauma. Because if you don't take into account the skills that the child lost or never developed early on, you're not going to give the child all the tools he needs to succeed. Simply processing the trauma is not adequate. Alan Shore is one of the most important authors on early development, on attachment, on regulation, and so forth. And his writings tend to be quite ponderous and tough to get through, although critically important in our field. But one of the simpler things he said is that a mother's primary job in the first year of life is to increase positive emotion. This is done through right brain play and social connection. It happens through touch, voice tone, eye contact, facial expression, rhythm, motion, and play. And if you think of parents and children together, those are the ways that they interact. We just naturally begin to sing songs, to play touching games, to do rhyming, to do sing-song talking. And those things are very important for a child whose developing right brain is just soaking it up. Another important piece of the early caregiver relationship is that the parent and the infant, and I'm talking about mothers, but it can be any parent caregiver, their communication and their feelings are contingent. That means one follows the other in very close succession. And they're collaborative increasingly. When a baby's tiny, there's not as much collaboration, but as you watch development over months, you begin to see more of the baby leading the interaction and the mother responding, then the mother responding and the baby leading. I mean, the mother leading and the baby responding. Barry Brazelton has called this the dance between the mother and the baby. And I spent some years doing research on this, where we did coding of mother and infant interaction on a second-by-second basis. So each second we had a split screen. Mothers were on one side, babies were on the other side. One person was coding what was the baby's feeling or behavior in each second. And another person was coding what was the mother's behavior and feeling in each second. And it is astounding how closely related they are in time, so that one of them will lead, the other will immediately follow with a response that is contingent and collaborative. Then it will go back and forth. The baby may take a break. Then they'll come back together. But it is really a dance, and it's lovely to see. Face-to-face interactions with a baby excite the baby. So a good caregiver will regulate that level of energy so that the baby doesn't become overexcited and is able to stay with the interaction. When you see children who've had profound neglect, like the children we've seen coming out of Eastern European orphanages, often they'll look almost autistic, and there's actually a phenomenon called institutional autism. And sometimes it's hard to know whether a child who's fairly recently out of a situation like that is actually autistic, or if they have experienced enough deprivation that they just look autistic. I remember a period of time in my life when I was working with a testing specialist who could diagnose autism. And some of the kids I would see would be diagnosed as autistic by her at one time, maybe a year or two later, no longer autistic. Maybe a year later, autistic again. This really confused me, as you can imagine. And I talked to her. And she said it really is almost impossible to tell when a child has some of the features of autism that come from very profound neglect, whether that really is autism. On the other hand, I think I've seen children who looked that way early on change significantly. And so anyway, these behaviors that you tend to see are self-stimulation. So children may flap, they may clap, they may bang their heads, they may masturbate excessively. They may seem in their own world. They really don't know how to have a relationship. They don't know how to have eye contact. They haven't learned that from experience. And we just don't know how much this can be moderated by intervention. On the other hand, I have, for instance, an example from my own work with clients of a young girl who was adopted from Romania at 18 months, looked at that time like about a six-month-old and couldn't hold her head up. She, when I last saw her, was about 14, and she had moved out of looking quite autistic in probably kindergarten and first grade to being able to interact, being able to understand a joke, being able to understand sarcasm, even though she was still quite concrete in many ways and somewhat obsessive. She was interacting well with people. She had good eye contact. She was beginning to learn to read nonverbal cues much better. And when I last heard about her, she's going to college and is able to function on her own quite well. So I think you do see changes like that in children who look institutionally autistic. So thinking about resilience, because obviously that's really critical when somebody's had negative experiences early on, infant resilience comes from a pattern of cycling from positive to negative and back to positive again. And it's important that the negative happens because the child has to learn how to move back to positive. So we don't want to protect children from everything negative. But the way that this occurs is in well-regulated interactions with a predictable caregiver that create a sense of safety as well as a sense of excitement and curiosity about the world. All of these factors are critical to later mental health, as you can imagine, I think. So now let's talk about the processes through which these right brain capabilities are created. Mothers and infants' arousal, as I talked about earlier, are synchronized within a split second of each other. This synchronization creates a psychophysiological state in the infant that matches the mother. Alan Shore has talked about the mother downloading her right brain into the infant's right brain. And what we do know is that if you look at the right brain patterns of a caregiving mother and a baby, they will match. Dan Siegel has called this interpersonal neurobiology, that there actually is a neurobiology that goes between people, usually in a dyadic situation. So the way we tend to think of this process happening is through an attuned caregiver. And attunement is an important concept. It's different from empathy. It means feeling with rather than feeling for. So I'm not feeling your pain, as Bill Clinton might say. I am feeling with you. And really experiencing your experience. Dan Siegel has called it feeling felt by. And when a parent is attuned, they read the baby's cues and they communicate back that the feeling is known and shared. This is critical to later social development, because we need to understand that other people can get us, can understand who we are. And this leads to an intersubjectivity of back and forth sharing that's about reading cues and knowing that you are known by another. So mother's attunement enables her to organize the baby states and promote the development of the baby's right brain. And gradually, the infant learns to attune to the mother, which is clearly an important skill in all social situations, and certainly as that infant becomes a parent, him or herself. And then there is reciprocal interaction and organization, and the regulation that has been the mother's becomes a collaborative process. I'm going to read a couple of quotes from Alan Shore, which are a little bit dense, but I think they really add some important information here. So one of the things he has said is, "The moment-to-moment expressions of the mother's regulatory functions occur at levels beneath awareness. Even so, the attuned mother can self-correct by accessing her own reflective function, whereby she monitors not only her infant's, but her own internal signals and differentiates her own affective state. She also regulates the type and intensity of socio-affective information within the dyad's communication system." Another quote from Shore: "Psychobiological attunement and the interactive mutual entrainment of physiological rhythms are fundamental processes that mediate attachment bond formation. And attachment can be defined as the regulation of biological synchronicity between organisms." Now, I want to give you a concrete example of how this works, and I'm going to show you a film of what is called a still face procedure being run in Edtronics Labs in Boston. Still face procedure has proven to be a really important step on our understanding of this mother-infant dance that occurs and the way in which parents provide regulation to their children. In a still face, as you will see, the mother and the child are face-to-face, baby's in a little seat, mother's right in front of him. For a few minutes, they play back and forth, talk, tickle, sing, whatever is usual for them. At a signal, the mother is told to make her face still with no feeling. And for a minute, she does that. She keeps her face completely expressionless. And what you'll see is how the baby disorganizes during that time, how important it is that there's this back and forth engagement. Often when you see this happen, babies begin to look more young than they have been in the interaction. They begin to look less organized, less able to manage their own state. And some babies, as they get a little older, will try all kinds of tricks to get mom. And I think in this film, you'll see a couple of the tricks that the baby uses to try to get mom involved again. They'll flirt, they'll reach out, they'll point, they'll yell, they'll do anything to get mom back with them. And then you'll see, as soon as mom does start showing expression again, how quickly this baby re-regulates with her. Some babies who really haven't had as adequate parenting take much longer or don't re-regulate, and they really can't come back from a loss like that. But this has been one of the important steps in our learning about how babies require this responsive interaction at all times. And if you think about children you may have seen who had parents who were addicted, who were severely depressed, other things that would cause parents to neglect a child or to just not be responsive. You can see why development is so compromised. One of the things Shore mentioned in one of those quotes I gave you was reflective function. And reflective function, if you haven't read about it, it's a great thing to understand a little more about as a therapist. Peter Fonagy and Mary Target have written about this. And they've talked about the way a secure caregiver can use attunement to the infant or the child as a way to communicate her understanding of the child's experience so that the child begins to understand that there are others who can not only understand him, but also help him become the person that the caregiver is seeing. And we all do this as parents. We see our kids as when they're babies, as far more than they are. And if we can reflect that back to the child can begin to grow into that conception. Okay, I'm going to talk some more now about affect regulation and its importance in the child's life. We've talked about that as a right brain skill that's learned in the first few years. What we know about babies' brains is that they are experience-dependent. There's very little of development that can occur without information going on, without the baby receiving stimuli from the outside, and especially from people. One scientist has said that the infant's brain is designed to be molded by the environment it encounters. As I said, the newborn is poorly regulated, both physiologically and emotionally, and learns that regulation from caregivers. Over time, the baby internalizes the caregiver's affective regulation. And as a result, the baby sharing the mother's state, which we've called interpersonal neurobiology. And this means that the child is fairly well regulated and then can devote his or her energy to learning, enjoying things, and growing. A lack of affect regulation underlies all psychopathology and makes ordinary life very difficult. And this is not something you can develop on your own, really. This is something that has to be developed within a dyadic relationship. All right. So if we think about the way regulation proceeds in attachment development, we see external regulation by the caregiver early in life to co-regulation, where there's back and forth regulation, and finally to the ability to self-regulate by the infant. This is when the child has internalized the regulation that's been provided by the caregiver. A development of competency comes out of this. A sense of agency is also the result of a regulated brain. And that's one of the things we find people missing when they've had serious early trauma, is that sense of agency and a belief that they can do things. These are such fundamental skills that you can only really teach in a dyadic relationship. There's also, finally, after developing internal regulation, the child also develops collaborative problem solving. They're able to work in partnership with another. So that usually happens after the end of the first year of life. The child begins to be able to recruit the caregiver to help them solve a problem. As a child's attachment is developing toward the end of the first year, there begins to be, for the first time in the kid's life, when he starts crawling around and getting into things, he'll, for the very first time, hear no. And when you think about it, a little baby receives, in the hands of good caregivers, receives such adoration and love. And you can imagine what a shock it is when they suddenly start hearing no. And sometimes that no is very loud and decisive and accompanied by mom picking up the baby and grabbing him away from the electric outlet or the street that he's about to crawl into or the dirt that he's about to eat. When this happens, if you remember yourself as a parent or seeing families, a toddler just melts like a puddle on the floor, crying. He's devastated by this no. And, of course, no's are essential for the child, but it can be hard for parents to see what happens when they say no. But, in fact, this is an important part of a building block of attachment called interactive repair. So a sensitive parent at this point where the child is on the floor in misery will pick him up and repair the broken feelings by explaining that, you know, I love you very much and you're a wonderful baby, but if you crawl in the street, you're going to get hurt. If you eat the dirt, it might make you sick. If you touch the electric outlet, it will hurt you. The caregiver explains it. And of course, you know, a 9-month-old, 10-month-old can't understand this. But the point of the repair is, I love you. You can't do this. Let's find something else to do together. So if you think about the number of times a baby does something they can't do, it's thousands. So there's no again and again and again and again in this toddler's life. But there's also a repair again and again and again and again. So over thousands of times, the child learns that he or she is lovable, even when he does things that are wrong. And the child develops the confidence to learn to repair breaks with others and to try new and challenging tasks where there may be mistakes made, there may be hurts, there may be other things that need to be repaired. So it provides a profoundly important building block for life, because we've got lots of times when we're going to make mistakes and when we're going to hurt people, and if we can repair, we have an important skill. So two pieces of what I call brain wisdom. Bruce Perry, who runs a wonderful child trauma institute in Texas and writes beautifully, certainly I would track down his writings if you're interested. He says, states, internal states, become traits, which become a lifetime pattern. So the feelings you have that are predominant feelings begin to become more embedded as traits. And what Dan Siegel has said, which is a paraphrase of the old Hebbian hypothesis, he says, what fires together wires together. So what we're learning, this is all part of the fact that the child's experience, the child's brain is molded by experience. If they are, if the neurons are firing together again and again and again and again in similar ways, eventually that will become a pathway that's easily traveled. And that's one of the things we face as therapists is helping people change those firing patterns so that the pathways begin to shift. And fortunately, what we've learned is that that's possible, even as adults. All right, I'm going to talk a little bit about what we call patterns of attachment or styles of attachment. These describe, when you're talking about a baby and their style of attachment, whether they're secure or insecure, for instance, we're talking about describing the relationship, not the child. So the child isn't a secure child. The child has a secure relationship with a mother, maybe with a father. They may have different attachment relationships with the mother and the father. They can be secure with one and insecure with the other. But as development goes on, these secure and insecure patterns become internalized into what we call an internal working model. And the internal working model includes the child's conception about themselves, about the caregiving environment, and about the world more generally. And the way these patterns are established is by sensitive and responsive caregiving, or the lack of sensitive and responsive caregiving. So here's very grossly overstated, but general sense of how internal working models might be seen. A baby who's secure, or an adult who has a secure working model, sees the self as lovable, worthy, and good. Sees others as helpful, trustworthy, and basically good. And sees the world as safe and predictable, in large part. Insecure attachments, more generally, and they're it's sort of like Tolstoy said, all happy families are the same, unhappy families each has its own story. There's one form of secure attachment. There are many ways in which you can be insecure. So generally, in an insecure attachment, you see yourself as unlovable, unworthy, and bad. You see others as hurtful, untrustworthy, and maybe even coercive. And you see the world as dangerous and chaotic, or a place not to be explored. So why does this matter? Well, we carry our working model with us into new relationships that we have. And our working model actually shapes these relationships by our expectations. And if you think of meeting people, you know, if you meet someone who approaches you without good eye contact, who sort of, you know, says, hi, you know, who cares, is the feeling you get from them. They may answer your questions briefly or scornfully or dismissively. You don't feel like being a friend with that person. And that person, who may have what we call a dismissing attachment, has reinforced his attachment by causing you to not want to be close to them. So they go into the interaction feeling like, people don't like me, I don't want to get to know people because they're not that great anyway. And the way they approach the interaction actually causes their expectation to happen. And so people avoid them. If you meet someone who comes on with a smile, who looks at you directly, who seems genuinely interested to meet you, who wants to hear what you have to say, you're much more likely to want to befriend that person. And that person has brought their secure model of attachment with them, and has given you the sense that you're worthy and important as well as their being worthy and important. So their own secure model will tend to evoke similar responses in others. And in that way, we tend to shape our world. So and when we search for a partner in life, we tend to choose based on models from our previous caregiving relationships. One of the things, the most exciting aspects of attachment research in recent years has been the work on intergenerational transmission of attachment. We developed ways of measuring adult attachment that seem to be parallel to the ways in which we measure infant and child attachment. And a group of people had the idea of doing adult attachment interviews with mothers who were pregnant, and a year later doing an attachment assessment of a baby and that same mother. They found a 75% predictive concordance of the mother's model of attachment with the baby's relationship with the mother. And in another study where foster babies and mothers were tested, they found a 72% correlation between the baby's attachment and the foster mother's attachment prior to being with the baby. These are astonishing figures, and they really indicate how important it is that the attachment relationship in the first year of life, how much it shapes a baby's whole sense of how they're going to interact with others throughout their life. So when we talk about patterns of attachment, we generally talk about secure relationships or insecure. These aren't diagnoses. They're not psychological diagnoses. But they are ways which we've learned to measure in research settings primarily. And we think of insecure and secure, but I think a more important way to divide attachment relationships is by organized and disorganized. So an organized attachment means that a child has a way to get their attachment needs met. About 60 to 65% of babies in middle-class groups are securely attached. They meet their needs by seeking the caregiver when they're feeling sad, when they're hurt, when they're tired, or when they just want to share. And they take joy in seeing their parent when they return to their parent after a period of separation. Insecure babies tend to be split into insecure and organized babies tend to be split into avoidant babies, who are about 20 to 25% in middle-class groups. Avoidant babies tend to act as if they don't have much in the way of attachment relationships. They tend to, if mom has been away and comes back into the room, they tend to sort of act like, well, so who cares that you're back? In fact, if you measure these babies' physiological aspects, you'll find that they're very aroused if mother's away. And when mother comes back, they get much calmer. But they don't act that way. And the theory is that they've learned the best way to get whatever they can get from mom is not to act too needy. So they tend to be involved with toys or busy with something else. And that is their way of making sure they get whatever they can get from mom. The other group of insecure organized babies are called ambivalent or resistant. These babies get very upset if mom leaves the room, and they don't really get comforted when she comes back. They either are very angry, they may kick her and hit her and push on her, or they just may be dissolved in a puddle of tears and not be consolable when she comes back. A secure baby, when mom comes back to the room after a period of being away, may be crying, may reach for her, may want to be hugged and held, but after a few minutes is ready to get going again and doing the business of a baby, which is exploring the world and enjoying toys. So simply being insecure doesn't mean being pathological. It doesn't mean psychopathology. And I would say most of us, if you came into the field of social work, you're probably coming from some situation which was less than ideal as a child. My theory is that people who grew up very happy don't need to become therapists. We become therapists for reasons, for solving our own problems. And so many of us might have been avoidant or ambivalent as young children. And maybe we've worked our way out of that by now. But it's important to recognize that being avoidant or ambivalent doesn't mean having a diagnosis. I'm going to show you now this an example of the strange situation from Everett Waters' lab at Stony Brook in Long Island. And we're going to show you both secure and avoidant and ambivalent babies to give you an idea of how these babies look and how we measure their security. We do this in what's called a strange situation, which was developed by Mary Ainsworth. And in the strange situation, the mother and the baby come into a strange lab where there's video cameras, toys on the floor, chairs by the on the side of the room. And part of the point is that it's strange, so that the child is not in a secure setting where they feel comfortable. But mom's there, so they're okay for a while. Mom sits for a while, maybe plays with the baby, talks to the baby. Then a stranger comes in the room. The stranger talks to mom for a while, then sits down and plays with the baby, and then mom leaves the room. The baby may be upset. The baby may be not seeming upset. Maybe the baby plays with a stranger. Different babies do different things. But what we're looking for is what happens when mom comes back in the room. Does the baby greet mom? Does the baby get its needs met by mom? And then does the baby return to play? So you'll see different reactions of a secure and insecure, ambivalent and an insecure, avoidant baby. And the way in which these are rated is really almost entirely looking at how the reunion of the mother and the baby in each of the two reunions that occur in this strange situation, how those reunions take place. So now I'm going to show you the strange situation, and you'll have a chance to see for yourself how we measure attachment in infants. So one of the things you didn't see in this strange situation is a disorganized baby. I think because disorganized babies really are more pathological, and disorganization as an infant is associated with later pathological development. People tend not to maintain film banks of them, and they don't make them publicly available. So when a baby is disorganized in their attachment to a parent, the experience of that child is they have no way to get their needs met because the source of safety, which is the caregiver, and babies know that, is also the source of fear. And this is either because the parent is abusive or because the parent is frightening, scares the child in some way without being physically abusive. If the parent is the source of safety, the child knows they have to go to the source of safety when they feel fear, but the parent is also the source of fear. This puts the child in an irresolvable dilemma. They can't both seek safety and get away from fear. So in a strange situation, when these children are seen in reunion with their mother, they show all kinds of anomalous patterns. Some of them may freeze. Some of them may walk toward mom with their head covered like this. They may approach mom and then turn around and walk away. They may look just totally dazed. And we think this is probably a precursor of later dissociation. So they show one of these ways of really looking like this is way over my head. I don't know what to do in this situation. And we see this pattern commonly in children who've been maltreated. We also see it to some degree, for instance, in children where their parents have had a significant loss of, for instance, maybe one of the parents' own parents in the short time before the baby was born. So we see it not just in abusive parents, but parents who maybe aren't psychologically available to their babies. This is the only pattern of attachment that really is seen as a risk for later psychopathology and behavior problems. And it's a risk for both internalizing and externalizing problems in children. So other types of attachment reflect an organized system, as I said, and they help to organize later development. Whereas disorganization means that later development is more chaotic, and the baby tends not to develop these wonderful right brain skills, which are the foundation for most of the rest of life. So, in a disorganized baby, the baby sees the mother as a source of safety. Without her, the baby won't survive, and babies are aware of this on a very visceral level. But the mother is simultaneously the source of fear. And the baby is unable to approach when fearful or to flee, since there is no other safety. And that's what causes the freezing or the contradictory behaviors. The internal working model of a disorganized baby is of the self as not lovable, not likely to have his needs met, the caregiving environment as unpredictable or threatening, and the world as a dangerous place where you can't count on others. And this working model obviously has profound impact on later development. What are the results of this kind of disorganization? So we have not only a parent who's a source of fear, we have a parent who hasn't taught the child these wonderful skills that they need to take on all the problems of life. We may see extremes of emotional expression that occur and stop unpredictably. I've worked with parents who say, well, obviously, when my child is having tantrums, they're not really feeling this because they can stop on a dime. That doesn't mean they're not really feeling it. It means the way they've learned to regulate is to go from highly over-aroused to shutdown in 1 second. That's not an adaptive pattern. They're very hard to soothe. They often have poor regulation of sleep, appetite, bladder and bowels, and other body states. If you work with children who've had significant disorganization early in life, you spend an awful lot of time talking about their poop and their pee because they don't know how to regulate, even something as basic as that. The lack of trust in a secure caregiver means that the baby or the young child tries to meet their own needs, and often they will do anything to be in control. And you can understand this because a baby expects a grown-up to be in control. When they're not, the baby decides, I better handle this for myself. So when grown-ups later in their lives try to be in control, these babies will resist, these children will resist control by others very potently. And when you have a child whose goal is to be in control at all times, it's hard to be as strong as they are to assert control and safety so that they can begin to learn that they can be safe and secure. Their lack of trust also means they don't know how to be intimate with others. They're often very impulsive. They haven't learned to control impulses, to inhibit impulses. They may have an undeveloped conscience or a warped conscience. And they tend to make other people angry at themselves. And even in working with an adult client, if you've worked with an adult client who just makes you angry all the time, it's good to think back on whether this may be the source of that. So after there'd been a number of years of research on infant attachment, Mary Main and the other researchers in this field began to look at whether you could measure adult attachment in a similar way. And they found, by interviewing parents of the infants with whom they had done strange situations, they began to understand patterns in the adults that are parallel to the infant patterns. So some adults, many adults, have organized internal working models. That's what we call the way we measure an adult attachment. So organized adults may be secure or balanced, and these people are able to explain clearly what's gone on in their lives or to talk with you using both affect and rationality. Insecure adults who are organized may be dismissing. This is equivalent to the infant attachment of avoidant. Dismissing adults tend to defensively exclude the importance of affective information. They've learned not to put much emphasis on feelings or affect because as a baby, of course, they learned that the best way to get their needs met by their mother was to appear not to have many needs. As an adult, they've continued that pattern by just trying to convince themselves that they don't have many needs, and they tend to leave out affective information when they talk. Preoccupied adults are also organized attachment. They tend to defensively exclude some emotional information and some rational explanations, and they tend to not get their needs met well by others. Just as the baby couldn't be comforted by the mother, these adults are always looking for more. The adults who are not organized in their attachment styles are called unresolved in relation to trauma or loss. And they tend to show lapses in the monitoring of their discourse and a lack of coherence. I'll try to explain this a little better. And in a couple of minutes, I'll read from some adult attachment interviews to give you a better picture of how this works. So when you're assessing an adult's attachment style or a pattern, you interview them using something called the adult attachment interview, which is a semi-structured interview, which is, Mary Main has said, is designed to surprise the unconscious. And it's interesting how well this works, because I think most of us who have been trained to use the adult attachment interview, of course, at some point, have someone else give us the adult attachment interview. And I know in my case, and in the case of many of the people I worked with, our unconsciousnesses, I guess that's the word, were truly surprised. And I found myself in tears talking to my colleague about my early experiences because the way the questions are structured brings up re-experiencing of early feelings. So questions focus on the experience of having been parented, how one's parents responded to sicknesses or other difficult situations, whether parents were ever threatening, and how the adults feel their experience of being parented affects them today, and how they currently parent their children. It takes about an hour, a little over an hour sometimes, to do an adult attachment interview. And when you've done this interview, you record it, and it is then transcribed word for word and pause for pause, and it is rated in a very elaborate rating system, where the focus of the rating is on the coherence of the person's narrative. And coherence has very specific meanings. But the coherence means telling the story with appropriate feeling and without defensiveness, using enough examples and words to make the story clear, but not running on with irrelevant aspects of the story or other such things. A coherent narrative makes sense of one's life experiences. And it challenges early on egocentric beliefs. A coherent narrative tends to integrate positive and negative feelings and integrate across hemispheres of the brain. And coherence moves a person toward greater security of attachment. This may be sort of confusing, but I'm going to read to you from a few interviews and see if this doesn't give you a better sense of what we mean by coherent. Okay. One of the first questions on the adult attachment interview is that the person is asked to describe for each parent to give five adjectives that would describe their relationship with that parent as far back as they can remember. So here are three examples of adults who use the word loving in relationship to their mother. So the interviewer has just said, all right, the first word you gave to describe your relationship with your mother during childhood was loving. Can you think of a memory or incident that would illustrate for me why you chose that word? All right, here's a secure person talking about a mother who is loving. He says, loving. I don't know if this is the sort of thing you're looking for, but one thing that comes to mind is the way she stuck up for me when I got in trouble at school. Boy, if I told her about some problem at school and she thought I was in the right, or if I told her some kid or some teacher had treated me bad, she'd go out and investigate, and she'd stick up for me to the teacher or to the kid's parents or anybody, really. I could put it another way, too. I just knew where I stood with her and that she'd be comforting if I was upset or crying or something. The interviewer says, thank you. And the participant interrupts and continues, oh, you wanted a specific example. That time I set fire to the garage using my brother's chemistry set. I absolutely, positively wasn't supposed to use that. She came running when the neighbors phoned the fire department about the smoke. I expected to get the life lectured out of me, but she just ran straight for me and picked me up and hugged me real hard. Guess she was so scared and so glad to see me, she just forgot the lecture. Later, there were little hints at the dinner table about the incident, but I'd say basically what she did at the time, that was very loving. So there's a person who's able to describe well what that relationship felt like when he was young, and you really do get a sense of what it was like to be that child with that mother.